This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the latest instalment of the special In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM, focusing on autism spectrum disorder. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing clinical psychologist Dr. Vicky Ford, who is a specialist in autism spectrum disorder and part of the complex feeding team at Evelina London Children's Hospital. This podcast is supported by clinical partners. Today we're focusing on food sensitivities and proclivities in autistic children, looking at how to build a healthy relationship with food whilst understanding the challenges for many autistic children. Vicky, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Yes, hi, and thanks so much for asking me today to talk about feeding difficulties in children with autism. It's definitely an area I'm really passionate about, really working to improve the experience of young people and their families. So I think we realise how tough things can be for them, actually, with feeding. So I've been working as a clinical psychologist specialising in autism spectrum disorders since 2012. And in that time, I've worked both in community teams and also in hospital settings. So as you've mentioned, I'm currently the clinical psychologist in the complex feeding team at the Evelina. So I've been there for the last 3 years. We're really lucky in that we're a multidisciplinary team. So that means we've got a paediatrician, psychologist, speech and language therapist, occupational therapist, and of course, dietitians in our team. And we work really closely together. We take referrals from paediatricians, primarily across the southeast of England, but sometimes we see children sort of from right across the UK. So that's me.
Sounds very busy. Now, food overlaps with many aspects of life that challenge the coping skills of individuals on the autism spectrum. Can you talk through some of the difficulties that typically arise?
Yes, I think that's a really good observation, actually. I think probably one of the biggest factors is the sort of around the difficulties in flexible thinking for children and people with autism. So for most of us, a piece of toast is a piece of toast. However, for some people on the autistic spectrum, that's genuinely just not the case. So when you stop to think, there are so many ways one piece of toast can differ from another. For example, is it made with white bread, brown bread, 50-50 bread? You know, has it been lightly toasted and so it's only beige in colour? Or has it been toasted until it's sort of dark brown? You know, we might think, oh, it's fine. I've cut the toast into quarters just as the person likes it, just as the child likes it. But they might be having a really hard time actually recognizing that these four triangles in front of them are even the same food as the four squares of toast that they're familiar with. So I think that this is something that some of the parents listening with will really be able to identify with. And it's important for people around the child to really appreciate that this isn't them being fussy or difficult or, you know, being sort of challenging to kind of annoy people. This is actually really linked to their tendency to focus in on the detail. So they would sort of tend to see the specifics rather than sort of being able to make sense of the whole picture and perhaps a way that a neurotypically developing person or child would be able to.
Is that the difference then? Because lots of young children can be fussy or faddy about food. Is that kind of a level of detail the thing that differentiates a child with autism who has some issues around food as compared to a kid that's just a bit fussy?
So becoming more selective about which foods they will eat is a completely normal developmental stage that most children will go through. So it's called developmental food neophobia, and that simply means that children become more wary of eating new foods, and sometimes they sort of start refusing foods that they've eaten happily before. So I've heard it referred to as new means no, actually, which is quite a good way of sort of thinking about it. And it's a fear-based response, and it tends to occur most commonly in toddlers. So sort of it's sort of at its peak at around 18 months to 2 years old. And I think sort of really starts to occur as children become more aware of the sensory properties of food. So they're sort of becoming more sort of aware and interested in the appearance, the smell, the texture, the taste of a food. And this is a response that evolved to keep us safe when our ancestors had to forage for food. So obviously there sort of weren't any supermarkets, there weren't any best before dates. And so it really made sense that if a food was unfamiliar, so you come across some berries on a tree that you haven't seen before, you know, to be a bit cautious. Or perhaps if a food looked similar to a food you'd eaten before and that had made you ill, or even a food that perhaps had a bitter taste, which can be a sort of indicate that a food might not be safe to eat. It, you know, it did make sense for people to sort of be a bit hesitant before sort of eating a lot of that new food. And also it's sort of quite a social response. So we're more likely to eat a food that we sort of see others in our kind of social group eating on the whole, because that indicates that it's a safe food to eat. But with repeated exposure over time to a range of family foods, most children will sort of gradually, you know, grow out of that sort of response and they'll broaden their diet. But by the time they're sort of starting school, kind of around age 5, they're usually more willing to give new foods a go. But for children with autism, it's much less likely to happen without considerable sort of hard work by parents sort of, and sometimes by professionals. And I think really that's probably for several reasons. So the children with autism, that sort of concrete, rigid thinking style will persist, makes it harder for them to sort of broaden out the categories of foods they eat, as we sort of talked about. Also, children with autism might be less able to learn from copying others' eating behaviour. And in some cases, they can find the social aspects of mealtimes incredibly stressful. So it means they're sort of actually motivated to avoid eating around others at all. You know, we often work with young people who can't come to the table at all when the family are eating particular meals, you know, or they can't go into the kitchen when, you know, parents are preparing certain foods, or they have to eat in their bedroom because that's the only way they can keep their anxiety low enough to be able to eat at all. I think it's important to sort of say here that's sort of typically developing children, you know, will tend to gradually sort of lessen over time. But for some children, their difficulties of feeding will be so severe that they meet criteria for a diagnosis of ARFID. So ARFID stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. And that's actually a relatively newly recognised condition. So it was first defined in 2013. And what ARFID means really is it's a sort of a description of feeding difficulties. So might be like an apparent lack of interest in eating or food, a sort of avoidance of food based on some of the sensory characteristics, or a concern about some of the negative consequences of eating. For instance, maybe a fear of choking or a fear of being sick. And in order to be given a diagnosis of ARFID, the feeding difficulties must be severe enough that they're impacting the child's ability to meet their energy and sort of it's an and or their nutritional needs. So what does that look like in sort of reality? So typically either weight loss, or perhaps for a child because it might be faltering growth, so they're not kind of growing as you might have expected really. The nutritional deficiency, a lot of the children we see because of the sort of types of foods they eat might be quite low in iron, which can then obviously be having an impact on their development and having an impact physically. In sort of severe cases, the sort of the ARFID could kind of mean that the child's dependent on a sort of alternative source of feeding, so sort of tube feeding, so their intake's so limited. And the other sort of thing that's really, I think ARFID's a really helpful diagnosis in that it recognises that feeding difficulties also cause difficulties in psychosocial functioning. So in practice, that means everyday functioning. So we often see families who are, they can't go out to restaurants to eat because their child just wouldn't eat anything on the menu. They can't kind of go to family celebrations at other sort of family members' houses because the child wouldn't eat any food, or perhaps couldn't even cope with the family eating other food, watching that. And we often see families in clinic who are sort of taking whole suitcases of their child's safe and preferred foods away with them when they go on holiday because, you know, they're just terrified that they might spend 2 weeks in another country without any food that their child would eat.
And to get that diagnosis, presumably the first port of call would be your GP, would it?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So I think for parents sort of listening today who sort of feel like, yes, that sounds like my child, we're really struggling with this, I am concerned about their nutrition, I am concerned about their growth. Yes, we would absolutely say talk to your GP. They should have a kind of a good understanding of local services. So in sort of recent years, since I started working in this area, there had been a huge positive development in local feeding teams. So often local feeding teams might be led by dietitians, children's dietitians, who would have a good understanding of whether children are meeting their needs and would be able to support in offering advice about supplements or monitoring growth. But often these local feeding teams will be multidisciplinary. So they'll have occupational therapists who can advise around supporting around sensory properties of food and sensory difficulties around mealtimes as well.
Well, that's really helpful. I want to look at the advice that you have for parents or carers who find aspects of this frustrating or upsetting. So you've talked about that level of detail. My understanding is that children on the spectrum might also be extremely sensitive to flavors, colors, smells, or textures of food, or perhaps a preference for a very narrow selection of food, which you've already implied. But what advice do you have for parents or carers who are coping with this or trying to cope with this?
Yes, definitely. I think as many parents and people who work with children on the autistic spectrum will just be only too familiar with, research really recognises that up to 90% of these children will have sensory difficulties, and that can make eating really challenging, with food texture probably being recognised as one of the main factors that foods are rejected. So, you know, we often see children who are so highly sensitive, they even find watching others eat food distressing. So one sort of father described his daughter going completely pale and being terrified because her brother was eating porridge, which she finds the texture of very difficult, even though there was absolutely no expectation that she would have to eat any porridge. So that's just how sensitive, I suppose, an example of just how sensitive children can be. So as a parent, I completely understand how frustrating it can be when you've spent a long time preparing a sort of a nutritious, healthy meal and your child refuses to even try a little bit. But I think my advice for parents and carers would really be to try and think about the situation from their child's perspective. So some children will actually be able to tell parents what it is they find difficult about a particular food. And sort of usually, in our sort of my clinical experience, it's sort of foods with mixed textures. So that means things like a lasagna or a fish pie, a sort of spaghetti bolognese sauce. And it's sort of really thought that because the textures are mixed up, it's very hard for children to be able to pick out individual ingredients within that food and then to decide whether or not those ingredients fit into their safe categories or not. So sort of how can they trust that a food's going to be okay to eat if they can't really work out what's in it? And I think that's sort of part of the reason that children can become so stuck on processed foods, because if we sort of think about it, one McDonald's chicken nugget is pretty much exactly the same in sort of appearance, taste, smell, texture to another McDonald's chicken nugget, in a way that, you know, parents often sort of say, but I've made chicken nuggets at home and I just don't understand why they won't eat them. But often it's because each chicken nugget will sort of be so different from another one. So I think for parents, my advice would also be really to consider the sensory properties of the foods that their child can happily eat. So, kind of a considerable proportion of the children we see in clinic are beige eaters, we sort of describe them as. So they like dry, crunchy foods, foods without any sort of bright smells or bright colours or strong smells. And I've worked with quite a few children who are really sensitive to temperature as well. So one of the first children with autism that I worked with sort of well over 10 years ago now, he would only eat cold cheese sandwiches. And his mum very much understood that, not necessarily because of around the temperature of the food. It's because the smell of a food is much stronger often when it's heated up. So I think for parents, it's really important to sort of work out what it is that their child finds difficult in relation to the sensory properties and what it is they can cope with. I think the other thing that's really important as well is, parents have a good understanding of the sort of external senses we use to take in information about the world around us. So our sense of sight, our sense of touch, for example, our sense of smell. But also, we have senses that help us to understand sort of the processes and information from within our body. So one of those is the sense of interoception, which includes being aware of sort of feelings of hunger, feelings of fullness, the sensation of needing to go to the toilet. And a lot of children with autism actually seem to have real difficulties with this sense, and actually a very poor sense of their own interoception and what's going on within their bodies. And this can mean that, you know, they perhaps just wouldn't eat without external prompting. So they've understand that they've got a kind of uncomfortable feeling in their tummy, but they can't make that link with eating and feeling better. So I think it's really important for parents to think about that as well.
So the parents sort of have to regulate for them to some degree.
Yes, exactly. These children often wouldn't eat without either prompting from a parent or a caregiver, or from sometimes external cues in the environment. So perhaps the bell ringing at school, they understand, means time to eat.
And I'm wondering, for parents who have children who have perhaps these strong preferences for processed foods, as you've mentioned, and are rejecting nutritious options, should the parent try to help their son or daughter to eat a more balanced diet? Or is that a battle too far?
Yeah, I think that's a question we're often asked in clinic. I think it's a really difficult balance that parents are sort of trying to tread, really. I think my main message to parents would be to always ensure that each and every mealtime and snack time, their child's presented with at least one familiar food, so something that they feel really safe and comfortable to eat. So I know that that might sort of seem counterproductive to broadening their child's diet, sort of always offering something familiar. But actually, I think parents, you know, when we talk to parents, they've got such a good understanding of their own children. And they've, you know, received so much sort of, you know, very well-meaning advice over the years, you know, about, oh, well, just, you know, don't sort of offer them anything else and they'll eat it, you know, they'll eat when they're hungry. And I think the parents of children with genuine feeding difficulties really know that that's actually not the case. And that sort of, you know, well-intentioned advice, but just isn't going to work for their children. And I think the risk of withholding preferred foods is that the child just refuses to eat and then they become quite unwell or dehydrated. And we know that children with feeding difficulties find eating in mealtimes incredibly anxiety-provoking anyway. And by taking away their safe or preferred foods, you're only going to increase that anxiety level further. And so we also know that in a very stressed state, there are sort of physical chemical changes that happen in your body to reduce appetite and switch off your digestion. So it sort of makes this sort of higher anxiety level makes the child even less able to eat then as well. So we often talk to parents about that, and we sort of say, think about a time you've perhaps felt very stressed out, you know, a job interview or being late for something really important. And, you know, if someone offered you a meal, big meal, even something you'd really normally look forward to, like a roast dinner, would you be able to eat that meal? Mm. And parents sort of say, you know, definitely not. I'd feel really sick. I'd have butterflies in my tummy. And so we kind of get them to think about, again, the experience of the sort of anxiety level at mealtimes from their child's point of view. But having said all that, you know, we completely understand it's really important to help parents hold on to their hope that, you know, they can help their child to make some changes. And so, as we sort of talked about earlier, the key to sort of introducing a new food is really to do that kind of very gradually, playfully, and really without any pressure to actually eat the new food or taste the new food. So, you know, thinking about the sensory properties, one of the children who eats mainly dry, crunchy, beige foods, a parent could start thinking about introducing sort of dried apple crisps. You know, if they eat sort of crisps happily, what are sort of foods that are very similar but perhaps would get more fruit and vegetables in? So a sort of a parsnip crisp. So, and the really important thing is not to trick children. And I think, again, parents of children with feeding difficulties completely understand this. They've often sort of tried this in the past and sort of, you know, perhaps with, you know, out of necessity, there's this sort of, they've run out of the preferred brand of bread. And so they've bought some new bread and put it in the old bread bag. And children absolutely know at 100 paces that bread is not the same. So we would always sort of say, when parents are introducing a similar food with sort of similar sensory properties, to be really open and say, this is like the food you like, but it's not the same. And really for parents to think about sort of the possible risk of contamination there, because what you don't want to do is contaminate the safe food with the new food. So parents will be aware of their own child's level of sensitivity. But, you know, for some children, you might be able to introduce the new food on a plate next to the plate with the sort of preferred food on. Whereas for other children, you might need to actually introduce it at a different time of day to help them make that distinction.
Mm. You mentioned something about a different time of day. I want to look at routine. How does the need, or might the need for routine, play out in terms of ASD in a child's relationship with food and meal times?
Yeah, no, that's a really important point, I think. So, as you know, many parents are really well aware, children with autism often find transitions and change really difficult. And this sort of need for routine and structure can sometimes have a positive and a negative impact on their relationship with food. So, for instance, children, as we've sort of said, can be really stuck on eating a particular food at a certain mealtime, or they can become really fixed on the visual appearance of a food's packaging even. And then this kind of causes huge anxiety when that particular packet, you know, food isn't available, or the packaging is updated even. You know, we've had children reject food based on the updated packaging when they haven't actually changed the recipe of the food at all. I think that's something parents definitely will recognise, parents listening. But parents can also use the child's need for routine in a sort of positive way. So one example we often use with parents and families that we work with in clinic is to set a sort of beginning, middle and end routine for mealtime. So depending on their child's age and sort of abilities, the routine might look something like wash your hands, come to the table, help set the table, things like that. The middle would be sort of eating, serving the food and eating. And the end might be sort of to encourage the child to throw away any leftover food. Because we've noticed that actually children can be much more willing to interact with the food at the end of a meal. So for instance, they'll pick up their broccoli, you know, you'd be getting parents to encourage the child to pick up their broccoli and put it in the bin with their fingers, because then you've sort of got them sort of getting used to the sensation of the broccoli and the sort of looking at it and things in a way that, you know, children will do it then, because I think they don't think that parents are suddenly going to go, oh, you've touched it and thrown it in the bin. Great. Let's get it, you know, get it out and you can eat it now. You can taste it. Whereas I think sometimes children, you know, parents understandably are just excited that their child's shown any interest in the broccoli. And so we'll then sort of perhaps get too enthusiastic and the children can back off.
So there's a real logical sort of trajectory to it in a sense.
Yes. And also I think with mealtimes and eating, it's often an experience that children find really sort of difficult, and it can go on and on. And I think children with autism can struggle with a sense of time anyway. And so I think, you know, to have a clear beginning, middle and end sort of helps that sort of teach them that this activity is going to stop, you know, or even a sort of first then routine. So first we're going to do eating, then we're going to play or something like that. And it's not a kind of conditional thing. So it's not you've got to eat in order to kind of get down and go and play. It's just helping them to realise that there is an end to this activity.
Mm-hmm. No parent wants to make food a source of conflict. And as you've said, occasionally change will happen, and it would be outside of the family's control. The change of packaging was an example you gave. Can you talk through some strategies that parents or carers can use to help diffuse conflict when it does happen at mealtimes?
Yes, definitely. Conflict at mealtimes is just so tough on the whole family. So it impacts on the child, it impacts on parents, and of course it impacts on any siblings as well. I mean, sometimes mealtimes can just turn into such a battle that the whole family ends up dreading the next meal. And I think the difficulty is that, you know, when your child struggles in other areas, perhaps they're scared of traveling on public transport or, you know, to a greater or lesser degree, you can just avoid that situation or, you know, you can minimize their exposure. Sort of, you can travel at quieter times of day. You can, you know, walk instead of taking the bus. But with eating, it's just not that optional. And I think where we sort of really emphasize things with parents is that along with ensuring the access to familiar foods at every meal, we sort of really support them with the need to reduce pressure on their child to eat. So we completely understand that it's a parent's number one job to feed their child. And if their child's either refusing healthy foods, only eating small amounts of food, or perhaps not even eating at all, you know, it's just so anxiety provoking for parents, and parents want to do their best for their children. And I think sometimes that can sort of lead to them sort of really without meaning to putting quite a lot of pressure on the child to eat. So sometimes the sort of pressure can kind of come in the form of a sort of coaxing. So just one more bite, go on, just try a little bit, you know, a little bit more, go on, one more spoonful. And I think we've all done that. And sometimes it can sort of take more of a form of bribery and punishment. So perhaps you can't get down and play until you've finished your dinner, or come on, hurry up and finish your dinner and you can have your pudding. I think probably a lot of us were raised with that one. Or, you know, when you finish your dinner, you can have watch telly. But I think in some cases, the parents can actually become sort of, you know, in some severe cases, really frustrated and stressed about how little their child is eating. And this can lead to them force feeding. So, for instance, physically putting a piece of food in the child's mouth. And I think, you know, we understand that this really just comes out of the sort of sheer desperation for their child to eat, you know, and the understandable worry about the long-term consequences of their child not eating. But I think the difficulty is that whilst some of these approaches, so, you know, whether that's the coaxing or right up to the sort of force feeding, they might seem to work in the short term. But what the child has actually learned, or what the child's actually taken away from this, is that mealtimes are sort of unpleasant. And that can be either a sort of an emotional sort of distress, like sort of feeling anxious, or it could be an unpleasant physical sensation, like feeling too full, or even a sensory, a sort of a negative sensory reaction to a sort of a food texture. So, and then we often see families when they've become sort of trapped in a bit of a negative cycle. So the child's reluctant to eat, the parent's understandably anxious, the parent tries harder to get the child to eat, the child experiences that as sort of pressure and a negative experience at mealtimes and becomes more anxious and more reluctant to eat. So then the parent has to kind of becomes even more anxious because the child's restricted further and needs to kind of apply even more pressure to get the child to eat at the next mealtime.
If someone's locked in that sort of vicious cycle, how can they get out of it?
It's a really good point. So this is where the division of responsibility, and it's devised by someone in the States called Ellen Satter, and it's where that comes in, really. So in clinic, we teach parents that they've got certain responsibilities for their child's eating. So parents are responsible for choosing what food will be served, choosing when mealtimes and snack times are set, choosing where the food will be offered, but that the child has their own responsibilities that they come to mealtimes with. For instance, it's the child's responsibility to decide whether they're going to eat at that meal or snack time and how much they're going to eat. So it's a really, really nice approach, actually, because it sort of really encourages parents to understand mealtimes from their child's perspective. So, for instance, one of the things she talks about is being considerate of, you know, your own child's lack of experience with a new food. And it really supports parents to sort of learn to trust over time, to learn to trust their child to actually eat the amount of food that they need. And I think often, you know, with children, the sort of pressure to have one more bite, or, you know, I think a lot of us are probably raised with the, you've got to finish your plate, otherwise you can't get down. But actually what that's doing is it's overriding a child's natural ability to sort of listen to their, we call it listening to their tummy, and deciding whether their tummy is full or not and stopping eating.
I'm just wondering here about, we've talked about the impact on the family, and I'm wondering about other siblings. If you're all sitting around at mealtime, Is there any role for other siblings or something parents should think about if they have other children around meal times and when there's those kind of conflicts and considerations that arise?
Yeah, no, I think it is tricky. And we often sort of hear concern from parents that are worried, you know, understandably, that a sibling, sometimes a younger sibling, is copying the sort of food refusal, or they're sort of copying some of the sort of challenging behaviours around food and meal times. So yes, definitely. And I think it's also hard for parents sometimes to explain to siblings why one child might need to eat in front of the telly, but they're not allowed to eat in front of the telly. They've got to be sort of up at the table. So I think what we would sort of say is that these approaches around reducing pressure, reducing coaxing, teaching children to sort of learn about food gradually are actually all really good approaches to use with siblings as well. I think the tricky thing for children, perhaps with autism, is that they're sort of perhaps, as we sort of mentioned earlier, less able to learn from a social model. So often where you have neurotypically developing children, a younger child can be sort of motivated to eat by watching a sort of older sibling enjoy a particular vegetable or a particular food. But that's perhaps less likely to happen in a child with autism.
Vicky, what other tips and advice can you share for parents who have children on the spectrum of food sensitivities or proclivities?
Yeah, I think we've sort of just briefly touched on it, but I think it's really important to mention distraction here. So for the majority of children with only mild feeding difficulties, we'd really encourage parents to try to avoid a reliance on distraction to get their children to eat. So I guess we all know that experience, and you're sort of at the cinema with a massive box of popcorn, and then you look down and suddenly realise you've eaten it all and not really noticed because you weren't sort of engaging with it. And I think some parents, you know, the tendency can be sort of to notice that, oh, the child's eaten so much better in front of the telly. Let's just let them do that every day. And for children with mild feeding difficulties, we'd sort of say, ideally, to not to do that, really, because while they're distracted, they're not engaging with the food in front of them. So they're not learning about the sensory properties of the food. They're not learning from eating, you know, watching others eat and sort of eating as a family and learning the sort of social behaviours and things. But on the other hand, we'd say for some children with severe feeding difficulties, we completely understand that, you know, their anxiety levels are so high at meal times that the only way they are able to eat anywhere near an appropriate amount of food would be to be completely distracted, say, by an iPad. So in these cases, we would never advise parents to withhold the distraction, because I think they know, we know, that the child just won't eat. So instead, what we'd do is, in that situation, we'd sort of gradually support parents to reduce the reliance on distraction over time. So, for instance, we might work with them to think about what's the most difficult meal of the day. And often that's perhaps tea time or dinner time after school, because the child's just really worn out from school and, you know, been kind of coping with all the challenges of being at school all day. So we would say for that meal, absolutely, you know, use the iPad. But then we would say, perhaps start thinking with them, okay, maybe at the weekend when there's less demand to get everybody out of the house quickly, you know, could there be a meal there where the child didn't have the iPad? So that kind of thing.
What about for older children or teenagers on the spectrum for whom food is difficult? Can you suggest some ideas and coping strategies for them?
Yes, definitely. So when I meet with older children and adolescents in clinic, I'm really interested to talk to them about their own experience of the feeding difficulties. It's so interesting how often they have a really different perspective from their parents. And it's really important to find out sort of how food and mealtimes are causing stress for different members of the family, really. So, for example, some of the young people I talk to, they only eat a handful of sort of preferred foods over and over, and they're actually sort of reasonably happy with that because that's their way of managing their anxiety and it's working for them. But it's actually, you know, for the parents, it's a huge source of anxiety and stress because they're worried about the sort of nutrition and the longer term consequences of a limited diet, and it's sort of causing huge conflict in the family. But for the young person themselves, it's not actually something that they necessarily want to work on changing. But then I talked to other young people who are so bored of eating the same foods, you know, and they're sort of really frustrated. They can't eat the same foods as their friends. You know, they do feel they're sort of missing out on not being able to go out to restaurants and things. So often it's kind of not till they're a bit older that young people are really aware of the social sort of impact of their feeding difficulties. So I worked with one young person who the only source of fruit and vegetables in their diet was a sort of ready-made baby food sort of pouch and fruit pouch. And they'd previously, all through primary school, been very happy to have that fruit pouch in their lunchbox. But as they were going to secondary school, they were worried about being teased for eating baby food. So they stopped eating the fruit pouch. And then obviously that meant that there was no fruit and veg in their diet at all. So we sort of worked with that young person to think about how they could be a bit more flexible and maybe have the fruit pouch for breakfast instead before they went to school. Or I've worked with other young people who are incredibly worried about going away on a school residential trip because they're just not sure they're going to be able to eat any of the food available. So in that case, we sort of suggested to the parents that they kind of sat down with school and got the menu in advance and then really worked out with their young person to think about sort of what adaptations they might need to be able to go on the trip. So I think also when I'm working with a young person, I always try to think with them about their motivation to change. So what do they want to be different? You know, I often say, you know, if we had a magic wand, what's one thing you would change? And then what are some of the good things that would happen if we could make that change? What's been holding them back so far, you know, so far, like at this point, why haven't they made this change yet? Who can support them in kind of making this change happen? But I always take time as well to think what else is going on in their lives. So is this the right time to work on their feeding, really? Because, for instance, children might be going through a transition at school or they might have exams coming up. And at those sort of times of increased stress, they're sort of, it's likely that their food intake will restrict even further. They might become even more reliant on familiar foods to sort of manage their higher levels of anxiety in the rest of their life. Thing. So I think it's kind of really important that any goal is really collaborative and meaningful for the young person. So I'd also just say that I think what's I find sort of really enjoyable about working with older children is they're actually more able to articulate what it is about food they find difficult. So for example, the smell or how the texture might feel in their mouth. And we can explore some of the predictions with the young person. And then together we find ways of testing out these predictions in a way that feels manageable for them. So, you know, one young person I worked with said, I can't eat vegetables. They feel slimy. I'll be sick. And they were sort of very, very sort of black and white about that. So we might sort of in that case start by just looking at photos of vegetables and sort of talking about which ones might have a drier texture. And then we'd sort of move on to actually sort of exploring a range of vegetables by, you know, getting the young person to touch them, smell them, sort of lick them and things. And then we, you know, we always sort of talk about why it makes sense for us to be cautious actually about unfamiliar foods and how the only way to train your mind to recognize a food as safe is to make it more familiar by sort of lots and lots of opportunities to kind of learn about it really. So, and we always say to parents and to young people that for neurotypically developing children with no particular sensory issues, it can take around 15 to 20 exposures to a new food before they feel happy to put that in their mouth and taste it. So for children with a background of feeding difficulties and autism, it can take obviously considerably more sort of exposures for them to get to the same point. And I think that's really important because I think often, you know, children will try something once and then parents say it's almost the second time is the hardest. You know, they sort of parents kind of work them up to trying it once and then they sort of that's it. They'll never try it again. They've tried it and they didn't like it. So they don't see the point in doing it again, which is, you know, which makes sense. But I think with older children, you can explain that, you know, they're going to need to try it over and over and over. And you can also get them to rate their feelings about it over time as well. And they can sort of notice any changes in it. So.
You see older children broadening the range of food that they're willing to try and eat.
Yes, definitely. But it does take a huge effort from some of them, you know, to override. You know, often I recently worked with a teenage boy who'd sort of had the same limited diet of a handful of a few foods since, you know, since a toddler. then it's genuinely very scary then to start thinking about eating other foods. But, you know, he really understood the rationale of why it was important to do that from a sort of a nutrition point of view. And he was really motivated to do that as well. So, you know, he was prepared to sort of put himself, I think we explained to young people that they're going to have to put themselves out of their comfort zone a little bit to kind of learn about some of these things, but that actually that will pay off, you know, in terms of achieving some of their goals. But I think it's really important to link any work that you're doing to their goal so that they can see how what they're doing is sort of taking them a step closer to where they want to be.
The techniques you've described sound quite sort of specialised. They involve some expertise on your part. I'm just wondering, are these things that parents can do themselves, or should they be seeking professional help? And I suppose if so, at what stage should they be looking for professional support?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think feeding something that happens multiple times each day in a range of settings. So actually it's really important that everyone close to the child has a really good understanding of their eatings and their meal times and things. But I think it's definitely not something that, you know, you need a sort of high level of expertise to get started with at all. I think, you know, what's really helpful is building an understanding and a consistency across different settings. So, for example, you know, if a child knows that the lunchtime support staff at school are aware of their difficulties around food, then the child's going to feel safer to eat their lunch at school, you know, without sort of suddenly worrying that a teacher or somebody's going to come up and say, oh, you could just try that, or, oh, you're not going out to play, you haven't finished everything, you know. So I think that's really important. And we really often work in partnership with teachers, schools and families, just to think more generally about the impact of feeding difficulties on children. So this doesn't take any sort of expertise at all, but, you know, just thinking about how do some of the general school policies, so things like having a healthy packed lunch policy or only offering fruit at snack time, which is obviously great for the majority of children, but, you know, getting sort of families and schools to think together about what sort of reasonable adaptations they might need for children. For instance, like offering breadsticks as well as fruit at lunchtime. So just small changes like that can make a huge difference. We also know that from clinical experience, children can be lots more receptive to trying a new food in a new context. So actually, it's often easier to introduce a new food in a new environment like school. And also, children understand that they go to school to learn, and so they can be more open to exploring and learning it about new foods at school compared with how they would be at home. So I've definitely worked with some amazing teachers and teaching assistants who've just made such a difference to the children's feeding, and, you know, who've been able to use school lunchtimes as a sort of really regular opportunity to do that sort of gradual exposure and kind of decrease children's anxiety around mealtimes.
I'm just wondering, whose job is it to have that conversation with schools? If that's not happening in your child's school, should the parent be approaching the school and trying to give them some kind of psychoeducation? Whose role is that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think, yes, in the first instance, it can be really helpful for parents to have that conversation with their child's teacher, and with sort of especially the sort of the teacher to pass that information on to the staff who kind of support at lunchtimes, because parents obviously have the best understanding of their child's feeding difficulties, so they know what, you know, their child can manage and what their child really won't be able to cope with. And so, you know, we work with lots of sort of schools where they're very flexible and they really want to support these young people. And so, you know, they'll sort of work with parents and saying, okay, on one day a week on the school menu, it's chips. And we know this child can eat chips, so they can have a portion of chips alongside their packed lunch, you know, just to sort of kind of include them in lunch times. Or we've worked with schools where the child can't cope with the noise of the lunch hall and the sort of busyness and sometimes the kind of mess and chaos that goes with a sort of a busy school lunchtime. So, you know, schools have been really understanding and said, why doesn't that young person and perhaps a trusted friend, why don't they go in at the start of lunchtime when it's a bit quieter so that they can be done and coming out as it gets busier? And that's definitely something that we would really support parents to start having those conversations with schools. Yes.
Where, for those listening to this podcast, where can they go for more information or to find helpful resources on the issues we've talked about today?
Yeah, no, definitely. There are some really great resources out there. So I'd say one of the best is the Child Feeding Guide. So it's a website, childfeedingguide.co.uk. And it also has a free app. And really, it's sort of developed by Loughborough University. So it's all, and their sort of specialist team there. So it's all sort of evidence-based and sort of all the guidance is supported by research. It's got lots of great practical advice to sort of help parents understand their child's feeding behaviour and really to improve mealtimes as well. So it's a really good starting point for parents of all children, not just children with autism, who would be keen to learn more. And what I like about it is it's actually got a whole section devoted to encouraging your children to eat more fruit and vegetables, which I think probably most parents are sort of tearing their hair out about that at one point or another. But for parents who are really struggling with their child's feeding difficulties or who may be concerned that their child has ARFID, Gillian Harris and Elizabeth Shea, who are both psychologists with sort of huge experience in this area, they've got a great new book called Food Refusal and Avoidant Eating in Children, including those with autism spectrum conditions. It's really accessible and it sort of explains really well why some children just find eating so difficult. But it's also got lots of practical sort of strategies and sort of ideas and sort of suggestions for changes parents can make at home as well.
Great.
I mentioned earlier the Ellen Satter's website and her division of responsibility theory. That's her website, Ellen, E-L-L-Y-N-S-A-T-T-E-R, institute.org. And that has loads of helpful information and advice really focused on making mealtimes a more positive and stress-free experience for the whole family. So she's got lots of practical advice about how parents can reflect on their own relationships with food and then really to empower their children to kind of have more positive relationships with food, you know, really developing a positive relationship with food that's going to last their child a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then I'd also like to mention ARFID Awareness, which is ARFID, A-R-F-I-D, Awareness, UK.org. So it's a charity actually set up by parents and dedicated to raising awareness of ARFID and promoting current research and resources. So what's really helpful is they also host two online support communities. So one for parents of children with ARFID and one for professionals working with children with feeding difficulties. So, yeah, really good resources.
Vicky, is there anything you want to add that might be important or helpful to our listeners?
One helpful strategy we talk to parents a lot about is offering the easiest food at the most difficult time of day. And really this sort of strategy gives permission for parents to sort of break those quite sort of rigid rules we often have about what sort of foods are acceptable at what meal times or what time of day really. And so, for example, if the evening meal is the biggest struggle, then it could be okay for parents to offer a bowl of cereal if the child might otherwise be unable to eat anything at that time of day. So perhaps, you know, parents would have been resisting doing that because they feel like cereal is a breakfast food. But actually, if it means the child eating something before they go to bed and then having a better night's sleep because they're not waking up hungry, we'd be really supportive of parents in doing that. The other thing I just sort of wanted to mention briefly, we've sort of talked a bit already about children with a very repetitive pattern of eating. And often we see children who do what we call food jagging. So that just simply means eating the same food on repeat before suddenly dropping it. And one young person I work with had a sort of good explanation of it. They sort of said, my mind just flipped me off of it. So, and I said, why don't you want to eat the popcorn chicken or whatever it was anymore? My mind just flipped me off of it. Something sort of, I think it's really, we also sort of think about it in terms of sensory specific satiety. So that's a kind of a sort of way of basically saying that if we eat the same food over and over, we get sort of full up on it. And I think everybody would have that experience of sort of feeling very full on their main course, but then sort of when offered a pudding or sort of wanted offered the pudding menu, sort of suddenly found more room for a pudding. And that's because it's a different taste or a different flavour. So we're kind of able to eat more of it. And for children who only eat the same flavours over and over, their sort of body almost kind of kicks in and sort of moves them on to something else. So to sort of support parents in managing that, what we would say is to, it's really important for them to aim to maximize the variety within the children's safe foods. So for instance, if a child ate popcorn chicken, chicken nuggets and chicken goujons, and that was all they ate for dinner, then we'd say rather than offering chicken nuggets every night for a week, and risking the child, or every night for 3 weeks and risking the child then dropping chicken nuggets from their diet, we'd say offer those three foods on rotation. I guess it can seem a bit silly sometimes because they're sort of almost to us identical foods, but actually sort of quite a lot of sort of clinical experience and evidence is now showing that as much variation as possible within the limitations of the diet can be really helpful, keeping what kind of variation there is in that diet there.
Excellent. Thank you. Vicky, finally, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
I would want them to know that help is out there. It is really difficult, you know, managing a child who finds feeding and mealtimes difficult. I think for lots of families, it's really hard to get your head around because eating is something that most of us really enjoy. You know, eating is sort of something that most of us sort of really look forward to. And to have a child in your family who just finds it the absolute opposite experience can just be really tough on everybody. So I would say don't feel like you're the only person struggling with this. This is actually a really, really common issue. It's a really common issue, especially in children with autism. But we'd really encourage you to sort of seek help. So as I've sort of mentioned, there's lots of great free resources, and each of those resources I recommended have great links to other resources, sort of very reputable resources. Access the resources. And if you sort of feel like you really are struggling, then definitely talk to your GP and request a referral, you know, in the first instance to a local feeding team or a local pediatric dietitian. And they should be able to sort of then put you in contact with perhaps other groups in the community that are sort of supporting parents in a similar position.
Vicky, fantastic. Thank you ever so much. That's been really helpful. For more information on ASD and the issues covered in today's podcast, please visit www.acam.org or Twitter at ACAM. For more information on clinical partners, visit www.clinical-partners.co.uk.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.